Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, New Haven Firefighters Post-Decision Edition. Thanks for tuning in. On Monday, June 29th, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Ritchie v. DeStefano. In this case, the Supreme Court considered whether the City of New Haven committed racial discrimination in violation of the Equal Protection Clause or Title VII by rejecting the result of an otherwise valid civil service exam because of the racial distribution of the results. In a 5-4 decision delivered by Justice Kennedy, the court held that the city had violated Title VII and that the firefighters were entitled to summary judgment on their claim, reversing the Second Circuit decision below. To discuss the decision, we bring back from our post-argument podcast on this case, Michael Rossman, General Counsel for the Center for Individual Rights. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Rossman.
On June 29, 2009, the last day of the term, the Supreme Court handed down its opinion in Ritchie v. DeStefano, holding that the discarding of a civil service list because too many of the successful candidates were white violated Title VII's prohibition against intentional employment discrimination. The case arose from events that began in 2003, when the City of New Haven decided to make promotions in its fire department to the positions of captain and lieutenant. They hired a test development company, a company that specializes in designing tests that will both do the job of selecting the best applicants and withstand any legal challenge. The company talked to incumbents in the job to find out what the job qualifications were, conducted ride-along exercises with incumbent captains and lieutenants to learn about the job. It deliberately went out of its way to ride and talk with minority incumbents so as to preclude any argument that whites and minorities somehow understood the job differently. It then created a job questionnaire that it distributed to all incumbents and, after analyzing the answers, identified the important tasks and what it took to do them well. Only then did it start drafting the written test. A battalion chief from Atlanta reviewed it to ensure that it assessed merit. There was an oral component to the exam as well, and when the company assembled a pool of assessors to give the oral exams, minorities were overrepresented. Most panels of three assessors giving the oral exam were majority minority. Candidates were given materials to study from and 3 months to prepare. The results came out, and it turned out that African American and Hispanics did not do as well as whites. And at this point, we need to briefly review the disparate impact theory of employment discrimination under Title VII. The disparate impact theory, first adopted by the Supreme Court 38 years ago in Griggs versus Duke Power, says that a selection device for a job might violate Title VII if selection device tends to select members of one race or sex over another, and it is not one that is appropriate and serves an important business purpose, usually to select the better candidates. The Civil Rights Act of 1991 makes clear that the burden is on the employer to show that the selection device does a good job of selecting candidates. It also makes clear that an employer can be liable, even if the selection device is valid, if a plaintiff can prove that there are equally effective selection devices with less disparate impact and that the employer refused to adopt them. So, back to New Haven, where the promotion tests for captain and lieutenant have a disparate impact on blacks and Hispanics. The Civil Service Board has to certify before anyone can be hired, and the mayor and the city's attorney try to convince the board not to certify. The board holds a number of meetings. A rabble-rouser threatens the board with political ramifications. Test development experts, several of whom have not read the exams with great care, opine on it. Curiously, the fire department's chief and the assistant chief, the latter of whom was an African American, thought the exam was fair and valid, but they were not allowed to speak in the board's dispositive meeting. In any event, splitting 2-2, the Civil Service Board fails to certify. Those who would have been hired, 17 white and one Hispanic male, sue. They say, we spent huge chunks of time preparing. We gave up second jobs. Lead plaintiff Frank Ricci testifies that he paid someone to record the study preparation materials because he's dyslexic. Plaintiffs assert that the city of New Haven did not hire them because most of them are white. That, they allege, violates Title VII's and the 14th Amendment's prohibition on intentional discrimination. Summary judgment motions are filed. The district court granted the city summary judgment, and the Second Circuit affirmed, both holding that the city did not act because of race or ethnicity, and thus did not engage in intentional discrimination. According to those lower courts, any facially neutral effort to ameliorate the disparate impact of a selection device, and here the selection device is the civil service exam, regardless of how motivated, is not intentional discrimination. It deserves mention that no one on the Supreme Court adopted this particular view. In any event, the Supreme Court reversed. In an opinion by Justice Kennedy, whom listeners of my previous podcast prior to the decision may recall I incisively identified as a key vote on the case, the court held that discarding test results because of the race of the successful candidates is presumptively disparate treatment under Title VII. At the same time, it created an affirmative defense. An employer could avoid liability for disparate treatment under Title VII if it could show that it had a strong basis in evidence that it would have been liable under the disparate impact provisions of Title VII. The dissent by Justice Ginsburg, joined by Justices Stevens, Souter, and Breyer, would have adopted a good cause standard, where a defense, although Justice Ginsburg never quite calls it a defense, can be successful if the employer used a selection device and had good cause to believe that the selection device would not withstand examination for business necessity. Now, note the absence of any reference to liability under Title VII's disparate impact provision in this standard. For now, though, note that all nine justices would appear to have rejected the proposition that a statistical disparity alone, that some group defined by race, sex, ethnicity, or religion, did not do as well as the most successful, similarly defined group, is a sufficient basis for rejecting the results of a selection device. Now, at first glance, the difference between the strong basis in evidence standard that the court used and the good cause standard of the dissent might not seem to be all that great. As usual, though, the devil is in the details. The court rejected, as insufficient to meet its strong basis standard, speculative comments before the Civil Service Board about whether a different selection device would have selected more qualified individuals and or have had less disparate impact. Several suggestions were made, albeit some during litigation. For example, using different weights on the written and oral parts of the test that was used, or using a different selection device altogether, the so-called assessment center. The dissenters, on the other hand, reveled in such evidence. Of course, they argued, written tests could not possibly select good New Haven Fire Department captains and lieutenants, because everyone knows that being able to answer written questions is not a skill needed by those in such positions, an argument I think that would be true of many written civil service tests. Moreover, the dissenters asserted the weighting that New Haven gave the written test, 60% pursuant to a contract with the Firefighters Union, was well above the median weight given by other cities. The dissent does not explain why complying with one's contractual obligations is not deemed part of business necessity. The dissent notes that other cities use assessment centers, so it must be a superior method of selection. I should note here now that none of the opinions ever really explains what an assessment center is and how exactly it differs markedly from an oral examination. One thing to note about the dissent's analysis, aside from its willingness to consider any remarks or analysis as evidence, is the consequences it would have for actual disparate impact cases. Justice Ginsburg seems to place all possible flaws in an exam under the rubric of business necessity, including whether there are other better selection devices. That is, the dissent argues that a selection method or procedure is not necessary if there is a better alternative. This would be a rather startling change in disparate impact law, at least as I understand it, were it to be adopted, since it would essentially place the burden on the employer to show that its selection device and apparently each possible feature of it were not just good, but the best possible selection devices and features. This would reverse the burden generally assumed by the statute, that the defendant need only show that the overall selection device is a good one, and that it is the plaintiff in a disparate impact case who must show that there are selection devices that are just as good, but with less disparate impact. Speaking of reversing the burden, let's close this podcast with a look at Justice Kennedy's penultimate paragraph. In that paragraph, the court considers a hypothetical disparate impact case in order to answer the city's complaint that it was damned no matter what it did in this case. The court asserts that if the city is sued for disparate impact liability, it can defend that suit with a claim that it has a strong basis in evidence that it would be liable for disparate treatment if it had not used the results of the selection device. Presumably, this defense is not just for the city of New Haven, but for any defendant in any disparate impact lawsuit. And as far as I can tell, it would be available in almost any disparate impact lawsuit, since the failure to use the results of a selection device is almost certainly going to be partly motivated by the demographics of the successful applicants. So, what is a strong basis in evidence that you would have been liable for disparate treatment had you not used the results of the attacked selection device? Well, after Ricci, I take it that a strong basis in evidence of disparate treatment liability would be the absence of a strong basis in evidence of disparate impact liability. After all, New Haven was liable for disparate treatment, precisely because it lacked that strong basis of disparate impact liability. So, here are some questions about that defense. Is the absence of evidence that a test is invalid, which is clearly something less than evidence that it is valid, a sufficiently strong basis in evidence that you will be liable for disparate treatment? If not, is the fact that the test was carefully crafted by a professional company willing to defend its job-relatedness sufficient? Ricci seems to say so, yet that would essentially mean that an employer would no longer need to defend a selection device that has disparate impact with solid evidence that the device is job-related, which is certainly what the statute says now. Keep in mind that there are several statistical methods available to validate a selection device. What if an employer has evidence that one method of validating a test would fail to validate it, but has mixed evidence or no evidence one way or the other as to whether other statistical methods could succeed? Perhaps that is a strong basis in evidence the employer would be liable for disparate treatment if it does not use the results of the selection device. If I understand it correctly, then, the court's affirmative defense, which it created itself to reconcile the two kinds of Title VII liability, would reverse the burden that Congress placed on employers in 1991. Well, we'll see if that actually happens over the course of time. Frankly, I tend to think it won't. More likely, I've either misunderstood the court's dicta, or the court has simply not thought about it much. There's much else to be said about the opinions, including very interesting concurrences by Justice Scalia for himself and Justice Alito, joined by Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas. But time being limited, you will have to surmise those things for yourselves after having read the opinions.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.